Hello, and welcome to this month edition of Go Nuts. I'm here with my friend Sandy, and we're here to chat about her extraordinary career. Sandy, can you please introduce yourself?
I am Sandy Anagnostakis. Because of the last name, lots of people call me Dr. Sandy, which is fine. And I have worked for many years on chestnut trees and other tree crops. Most of my career at the Connecticut Agricultural Experiment Station in New Haven.
Excellent. I was really inspired to ask you to join me today because you've been sending me some of your past work, as well as I was really inspired because you sent me a picture of a young Sandy in the lab working. And, I talk about how much I love history and I love empowered women and, you know, women in science. It's a big conversation. And it makes me happy to know so many prestigious women in the science field. So that's why I kind of invited you today to talk about that. So how did you get started with all of this?
Well, I think having been an only child and a terminal introvert, it was very easy for me to drift into science, and I was first really helped in high school because I had a chemistry teacher who thought that I was brilliant, which was not true, but I really enjoyed the chemistry course and I worked hard in it. Then I decided, okay, that's terrific. I'm going to go to college. I'm going to become a veterinarian. And I went to college at the University of California at Riverside, where I was told, oh, women can't be veterinarians. That's a job for men. And started revising my future. Let's see. Then I worked for a year at UCLA as a technician in a laboratory, and then I got married, and my husband had a fellowship at University of Texas in Austin, so we went to Austin, Texas, where extreme boredom sat in for me, because I was trying to be a stay-at-home wife who did all of those important domestic things, but it was not working out. So I started graduate work. I was fortunate that at the University of Texas, there were several famous botanists who had been hired, people who were near the ends of their careers. And the university had decided that they would hire these wonderful guys to come and teach in the botany department and sort of upgrade the reputation of the place. And I was lucky enough to get to work with a man named Constantine John Alexopoulos, who was a mycologist, absolutely first rate, and somebody with enormous enthusiasm for fungi. So I learned a lot, did a lot of work on slime mold, and learned how to use the electron microscope. I survived the shooting in the tower in Texas and managed to put the trauma of the president being killed in Texas sort of behind me. And let's see, then what happened? My husband got a job at Yale. So even though I'd finished a master's and had started more work, I, of course, could not just stay in Texas and finish. I went with my husband to New Haven. And I started looking for jobs, and that's when I had another really enormous stroke of luck. because at the Connecticut Agricultural Experiment Station, the head of the genetics department was Peter Day, who looked at my resume and said, "The only job I have available is a technician, and you are way overqualified." But he hired me anyway. I said, "I don't care, I need a job." So that was 1966. And I worked with Peter Day and a number of the other people in the experiment station who had problems with fungi, fungal diseases of plants. And then John Anderson, who was an entomologist, came in with some fungi on mosquitoes that he was really interested in. And of course, I was just, I've always been interested in things that are unusual. And we worked together on it. We described a new species and published my first paper at the experiment station on a new species of fungus that attacked mosquitoes. And as more and more papers got written, it started to become kind of embarrassing that I didn't have a PhD. I just had a master's. But in spite of that, the experiment station kept promoting me and paying me more money. Meanwhile, my first husband went off to California to make movies. I flew to Mexico and divorced him. That was quite an adventure. And continued working on interesting things at the experiment station. And that's when all of us in the genetics department became aware of chestnut problems. One of the people in the department was Richard James, who had been working for the Northern Nut Growers for many years. He edited two books and wrote a lot of papers. Most of his work was on chestnuts because he had studied with Arthur Graves, who was the first person to start a breeding program for chestnuts in Connecticut. And let's see, 1930 was when he started that. And Dick James was one of his students. So Dick came into my office one day and handed me a branch and said, "Look at this fungus. You're a mycologist. Why don't you work on this?" And I told him that chestnut blight was sort of an old problem, and everybody had worked on that in the early 1900s, and I didn't think there was anything to be done, which of course turned out to not be true. And I started working on that fungus and did a lot of laboratory work with John Puhala, another mycologist in the genetics department. And together we published several papers on the chestnut blight fungus and its life cycle, basically. Made some mutants so we could identify sexual offspring of the fungus and figure out how various genes segregated. And let's see, we had Jack Elliston, John Elliston, who was working at the time with Dick James, looking at the fungal disease in the forest. But then we saw a paper in, let's see, it was one of the forestry journals, saying that the disease in Italy was no longer a problem, and that someone in France was isolating strains of the fungus that seemed to be curing the disease. Now, do you want me to just keep talking, or do you have questions? Shall we go on from there?
I can jump in with another question. I mean, the more I talk to you, the more questions I have, and you know, about everything. And it's just your personal life. It's my dream one day to do my own podcast called The Extraordinary Lives of Everyday People. And this is where I want to branch off into that and be like, tell me about your time in Texas during the present, you know, but I can't, because that's not what this podcast is about. But you're giving me all these ideas, which is absolutely fascinating. So you started to talk about your work with chestnuts, which is kind of what's relevant for this podcast.
Right.
And first of all, I love the fact that you got into it very similarly as I got into the NNGA, in that, here, take a look at this. Can you do something about it? And then, you know, however many years later, you continue to do it. So how familiar were you with the chestnut, like, because it sounds like you knew quite a bit about it when you were handed the first kind of fungal sample, and it sounds like you knew a little bit about it. What was your background in chestnuts before this?
Well, because Richard James was in the same department I was in, he had talked about the problems of chestnut blight and had also talked about the breeding work that Arthur Graves had done. So I was aware of that. I was surprised that there had been no recent genetics work done with the fungus, because there's a similar fungus in the same family, same order, which had lots of genetics that had been published. And so it was easy for John Pohalla and for me to kind of take off what was known on these other fungi and just get basic information about the fungus itself. But it wasn't until Dick brought me the branch with the canker on it, and I started working with it, that I really started paying attention to the literature that was coming out of other countries on chestnuts. And then when we read this paper from first from Italy, and then some papers from France about the potential for a cure, we all got very excited, because I had done some work with Peter Day on a virus in a different fungus, corn smut fungus. So we had some expertise with viruses, and we all said, well, I bet that's a virus that's causing this chestnut blight fungus to no longer be virulent. So I wrote in 1972, I wrote a letter to the guy in France who had done all this extraordinary work showing that some of the strains of the fungus not only didn't cause disease, but could cure cankers that had already started. I wrote to him first a nice letter in English, very polite, and I got no answer for a month. And then I had a friend of mine who was a high school French teacher. I had her translate my letter into French, using all of the polite terms that a respectful female would write to an exalted male. And I had no idea who this man was. And I sent my letter off, and the cultures arrived in the mail within 2 weeks. I found out later that he didn't speak English. Mm. And he'd gotten my letter, and he'd put it aside intending to translate it, and hadn't gotten around to it yet. So when he got the letter in French, he was happy to have somebody interested to do some more work on this unusual fungus that he'd found, which appeared to be able to cure chestnut blight. And that started a long collaboration back and forth between the Connecticut Experiment Station and this wonderful scientist in France. His name was Jean Grant. And Grant was doing lots of work trying to keep the chestnut trees in his part of Clermont-Ferrand from dying of blight. I have a good story about that too. I'll leave that for later. But we grew up the fungus very quickly in our lab, and with the help of Alan Dodds, we were able to show that, in fact, the unusual fungus, which appeared to cure chestnut blight, had a virus in it. And it was an unusual virus, but it could be passed from one strain of the fungus to another. We applied for permission to the, it would have been plant quarantine. We asked permission first to test it in the greenhouse and then to test it outdoors. And so after greenhouse tests showed that, in fact, if we put this fungus into a blight canker on potted trees, it would cure the canker. Then they gave us permission to try it outdoors. So Dick James planted 75 American chestnuts. He got them from Ivan Thor in Tennessee. Thor had been collecting seed and growing American chestnuts up in a nursery setting for several years, trying to get enough stock to do experiments with. And so we planted those trees. The seed came from Michigan and Wisconsin, which were outside the range of chestnut blight at that time. And we treated every canker we could find on those trees for 4 years in a row. And that meant every canker we could reach, of course. Mm-hmm. The trees were 2 and 3 years old when planted. By 1978, it was clear that not every canker would be healed by this wonderful mixture of virus-containing strains that we were using, which sent me back to the laboratory, where I discovered that the fungus had a system of incompatibility, which meant that there were genes, lots of genes, which kept the strains from fusing with each other. And if they couldn't fuse, if you put a virus-containing strain into a canker and it couldn't fuse with the fungus causing the canker, then the virus couldn't be transferred and the canker wouldn't be cured. Mm-hmm. So Peter Day and I wrote several papers about this genetic system that kept the fungal strains from fusing with each other. We started using mixtures of a whole bunch of different strains. We could test them in the lab and find out if they were the same or different. Managed to get the virus, this is the French virus now, managed to get it into everything we, every different strain we found, sometimes by going kind of around the, to putting it into one and putting that into something else until we got the virus into lots of different strains. And we use these mixtures in our American orchard. And that not only was successful, but after 4 years, we stopped treating cankers. And to this day, that orchard is basically alive and well, because the virus now is transferring to every new canker that comes up. What's really interesting in that little plot of trees, I think there are 70 left alive, you can see easily that not all American chestnuts are created equal, because some of those trees are the original stems. That's about a third of them. Some of them died back once and sprouted, as chestnuts do, of course, and then the sprouts were growing. Now, both the original trees and the sprouts had cankers all over them, from the base almost to the top. But the cankers were swollen up, indicating that the fungus in those cankers had the virus. And that was preventing the fungus from getting into the living wood of the tree and killing it. But a lot of the trees continue to die back to the ground, even though the virus is being transferred around all through the orchard and actually all over the farm now. Some of the trees didn't have enough vigor or resistance or something to keep them alive, even in the presence of the virus-containing fungus. So we called the strains with the virus, we called hypovirulent, less than normal virulent, because the virus didn't kill the strains, the fungus. The virus just weakened it. And we were really excited. We were convinced that this would be a way of keeping chestnuts alive in the forest. But we discovered fairly quickly, after a number of pretty major forest experiments, that the stress and competition of existing with lots of other trees in a forest put so much pressure on the trees that even the presence of the hypovirulent strains wasn't enough to keep the population of trees growing, which was very discouraging. So we started looking for other things that might be involved in the problem. We had a conference that we helped set up in West Virginia. It was the first major conference on chestnut blight, and we were able to bring a grant from France, and Ivan Thor was there from Tennessee. Bill McDonald from West Virginia was a major organizer of the conference. We had Tullio Turchetti from Italy, and a lot of the major players in the chestnut blight business. By then, of course, this was 1978. By 1978, there were a lot of people excited about chestnuts again. And because of this conference, we were able to form a federal project, which brought in money from the federal government through the Hatch Act to pay people in land-grant colleges or associated with land-grant colleges to work on chestnut projects. And that project, which started in 1978, is still going to this day. It's the longest continuing federal project, I think, of all of the ones that are being funded by the government. We learned a lot through colleagues in this federal project. And one of the things that we found out in 1978 was that a student of Ivan Thor's named David McCarroll had shown that the blight fungus produced a lot of oxalic acid. He tried various ways to see what oxalic acid would do in the chestnut tree, and he was convinced it was a virulence factor. So I took off with that because McCarroll went on to other things. I started working with Evelyn Haver at the experiment station, and we did a number of very detailed studies on the production of oxalic acid by the fungus. And we were able to show that the level of oxalic acid produced varied depending on the season. And then we showed that the strains of the fungus that contained the virus either produced almost no oxalic acid or were so limited in production that it could explain the inability of the fungus to kill trees. So we figured we'd found a virulence factor, and that oxalic acid was very important in the fungus killing trees. So when people in Syracuse were interested in looking for genes that might keep the tree alive, if they could get it in using GMO techniques, they found Bill Powell found a gene in wheat that would shut down the enzyme which makes oxalic acid. And he successfully transferred it into American chestnut. And I'm sure everybody has read that he has American chestnut trees with this one gene, which shuts down the production of oxalic acid, and the trees are resistant to blight. So I told Bill Powell the last time I saw him that I felt like a grandmother, that having started that work. But really, it was David McCarroll and Ivan Thor who made the first discovery.
What's amazing about this is it took an outside perspective to really get the ball rolling. It sounds like your background in fungi or in fungus really helped to bring this fresh perspective in that helped to kind of perpetuate or to be a catalyst for all of this research that has led to this point.
That's right. And the fact that as I said, I'm a terminal introvert, and I happily work away in the laboratory all by myself. But I would get ideas, and the advantage of the experiment station, the Connecticut experiment station, was that there were lots of people working in different areas of biology, of botany, and of entomology. And people talked to each other. So when I needed a chemist, I could walk across the lawn to the chemistry building and find a chemist. And and together we could brainstorm a problem. When I needed to work with an entomologist, I could find one who would talk to me, and we would consider the problem from several angles. And the same was true of genetics. Peter Day was a very, very good geneticist, and so his insights into all kinds of possibilities with the breeding, that was very helpful. Dick Janes continued the breeding of chestnut trees until he retired. I think it was 83, and that was the point at which I said, well, you know, I've been doing all this work with the fungus and treating fungal cankers and finding out about how they work. Surely breeding chestnut trees can't be that hard. So I took over breeding the chestnut trees, continuing the project that Arthur Graves started in 1930. His students, Hans Nienstadt and Dick Janes, had worked on for many years. And that was about the time that we started getting letters discussing the possibility of changing the breeding program. And it's interesting, the name has gone completely out of my mind. Wisconsin, Indiana, the old man who started who changed the breeding program was a very famous geneticist. And I'm sorry that I, at the moment, let's see, what's his name? Come on, Gina, help me here.
You're asking the wrong person. Although now I should know it because I was in Wisconsin when they were talking. I was in Wisconsin a couple years ago.
Yeah.
You'll think of it.
I'll think of it.